Session number 6245, reel 3.
Mr. Richards, reel 3. Now perhaps we could discuss your second camp at which you were interned for about 3 months in terms of the first camp before looking at the third camp at which you spent most of your time. Firstly, the layout of the second camp. How did this differ from the first?
It was a Roman Catholic school in one of the poorer areas of Kuching and in very swampy ground. It had no trees around it, so that it was much hotter and generally more unpleasant. Although it was bigger than the first camp, bungalow, it was also built of wood, and our numbers rose to 80, so there wasn't a great deal of extra room inside when all said and done. While we were there, we were greatly helped by a middle-aged Chinese woman who was very poor herself. She had a flock of children, and she ran considerable risks to make purchases for us in the shops, which were not very far away, and pushed them under the wire at night. Fortunately for her, she was never discovered, and she was paid after the war.
Was she not paid at all during that time?
Well, not unless she made a slight profit on what we bought through her, but quite likely not.
What I'm suggesting is that you did have some currency on you.
Well, some people had some, yes. And we began to pool all our resources of that kind. The compound inside the wire was all swamp and had at one time been a rubbish dump. And we tried to dig it up and plant sweet potatoes and things in it. But it was the most horrible mess. We were digging up bits of old tin cans and things. And a lot of us got very bad ulcers in consequence, because you only had to have a scratch on your leg and where you went.
Of course, you weren't there long enough, presumably, to harvest the fruit of your endeavours.
We may have had a few sweet potatoes, I don't remember. They only take about 3 months to grow. But
did the Japanese give you the seed potatoes as they've given you flour?
Well, I think so. I don't know how we acquired those. The sweet potatoes, you don't use seed potatoes, you use bits of the top and stick them in, and that would have been easy. It was while we were there that a Japanese general came and made a speech to us. We called him Teeth and Ribbons. And he went off about the British being a fourth-class nation and how they'd achieved their empire by robbery with violence. Now the Japanese were having their turn. But he repeated himself, and our interpreter, who had been in charge of Chinese affairs and spoke Chinese fluently, had, with the aid of his knowledge of Chinese characters, of course, been able to pick up Japanese very quickly indeed. So he interpreted for us. And he was almost so comic about it that he nearly caused disaster, because the good general would go off for a long, long paragraph. And the interpretation would be the general repeats himself the other way around. And it was all we could do to stop laughing, which of course we daren't do.
Were there any other features which distinguished this camp from the first? I'm thinking, for instance, in terms of morale.
No, I don't think so. It was betwixt and between, I suppose. our hopes, of course, remained very high in the first camp, and they remained fairly high in the second, but it began to look as if it was going to be a longer business than we had originally thought. But I don't think morale went down all that much. It was, I suppose it was resignation, partly it was the fact that we had all been in the country before. I suppose we thought we understood a bit of the Oriental mind, and we could, certain fatalism, we could take it. Rations were then pretty good by what they were later, so we weren't all that hungry.
What sort of rations did you have?
Again, I don't remember. I made basically rice and green veg. And
did you organise the cooking of it yourself?
Oh, yes. Well, we had to do everything for ourselves.
And what sort of organisation did you form in the second camp to deal out the food and so on?
That second camp is so foggy, I don't even remember what the kitchen looked like. But it was all... it was all communal, and I would imagine that it was in that second camp that we began organising, but in a very mild way, because we still weren't sure how long it was going to last. And we were much better organised in the third camp, when it was so obvious that it was going to be almost a permanency. And we had, after all, the officer administering the government, and chief secretary, and residents, and
a fair amount of expertise available.
Bankers, doctors, the lot, you see. So if we could, if that lot couldn't organise themselves, it was a pretty poor do.
Well, let's move now to the third camp, at which you spent about 3 1/4 years.
That's right.
Firstly, how did you get to the camp, and where was it located?
We were taken up there on the 14th of July, 1942, by lorry.
What were the conditions on the lorry?
Well, they were just open lorry, open 3-ton trucks. I mean, nobody fell out or anything. The camp was to the south of the town and consisted of the wooden thatched huts that had been the barracks for the Punjabi soldiers. There were, I don't know how many of them there were altogether, but we were divided into various sections. Australian officers, British officers, Dutch fathers, women and children, including nuns, British other ranks, Indonesians who had been fighting with the Dutch, and the remnants of the Punjabis, all wired off from one another inside a big perimeter fence. The huts were about 90 feet by 15 and something over 30 men in each hut.
Did this seem cramped?
Yes, except that we had space outs round about them, of course. And in our case, there was a central courtyard, just sand, and on the other side, on the outside, up against the wire, quite a lot of the remaining rubber trees from the rubber garden that had once been. So it was shaded to some extent. Yes, it was cramped. We had, for our actual sleeping space, sitting and reading space, we had about 6 planks wide, 6, 8, 48, that's 4 feet. by 6 foot long. And, well, I suppose it is cramped, yeah.
What kind of bedding did you have within the hut?
It varied. Some had none at all. And they made do with a kind of board structure. I don't remember. I think some people had, some of the lucky ones from North Borneo may have had camp bed mattresses or something of the kind. I had somewhere acquired a stretcher, probably an air raid precaution stretcher, which consisted of a wooden frame on short legs and four handles, covered with canvas. And that was all right, because the climate is such, of course, you don't need any bedding as such.
Did you ever have to repair your temporary bed?
Oh yes, it gave out after 18 months or so, split. And I replaced the canvas with cord made from banana stem fibre, which was, the stem was cut, split open, beaten out to get rid of the pulp, dried and soaked and beaten again, and finally rolled into cord. It wasn't very strong, nothing like hemp, ordinary banana, but it lasted the rest of the time.
How did you acquire it?
Oh, we grew the bananas, amongst other things.
Fine. We'll return shortly, I think, to the different type of work and activity that you did during those days. And if we can start with an overall structure, how did you organise yourselves as internees?
We were fairly democratic. We set up an organisation under the Office of the Ministry in the Government, Le Gros Clark, to make decisions and get rosters going, all that kind of thing, who was to do what work and when, in relation to Japanese orders in the matter, and they had a committee set up to administer all the money and clothing and so on, resources that we had with us, which was very little in our case from Sarawak, and that was fine. But when the the people from North Borneo came down, there were a lot of them, and then the Dutch from Dutch West Borneo, Kalimantan Barat, as it is now, our numbers grew to just over 250. And the people from North Borneo had been out for nearly a year. They had had notice of their departure from North Borneo, and they brought in suitcases of clothing, and they had books, they had money, they had all sorts of things. So we were the poor relation. They naturally didn't want to pool things with us. I mean, why should they? So this communal arrangement began then to break down a bit, and you got a lot of trading. People started to eat their own garden produce instead of handing it into the kitchens and so on. But there was enough of it left to see us through. The Japanese, of course, didn't understand how we did it. They were much, quite naturally, much more military about it. They expected to give orders to our commander, and the commander was to give orders to the various huts involved. Well, of course, he didn't give orders at all. He discussed it with everybody, and it looked all right as far as the Japanese were concerned.
As the Borneos, the people from North Borneo aside, Were there ever any problems with this more democratic approach?
Amongst ourselves? No, I don't think so, because by then we knew that the Japanese were pretty ruthless types, and I seem to remember we said too that it was probably just as well that it wasn't Chinese, because they might have been worse. And some of us knew something about the Chinese. So that kind of collaboration between us, cooperation perhaps is a better word, within the camp never really broke down altogether, because it was a matter of survival. I mean, had we started quarrelling amongst ourselves and the Japanese had got to know about it, they'd have been down on us like a ton of bricks and there'd been a lot of dead. So you had to find another way of sorting out any disagreement there was.
Were there any outstanding personalities amongst your democratic leadership?
Well, yes, they were. I don't remember who the members of the committee were now. I know that that Le Gros Clark was on it, and probably Digby, and I think almost certainly Lascelles and Archer. Salu probably as the interpreter, and representatives of North Borneo, of course. The outstanding ones from my point of view, apart from Le Gros Clark himself, of course, who was one of those who disappeared from human ken, that was because we had been getting in the local newspaper, first of all with Japanese providing it, then we smuggled it in for a while, and then it became obvious that it was too dangerous, but somebody insisted and started smuggling it in for himself. So the committee took it up again, and it was discovered. And all, it was a Japanese newspaper. So it couldn't have been damaging to anybody. They took a poor view of this, probably because they knew we had contact, you see, not because of the newspaper itself. Anyway, they took Le Gros Clark and four or five others away from the camp altogether. And we heard afterwards that some of them had died of dysentery and some had been shot and back in North Borneo.
How did the attitude of people from North Borneo change as presumably their own possessions became dispersed around the camp or whatever, the food supplies dwindled?
Well, they naturally began to cooperate a bit better when they began to run out. There was quite a lot of trading by then. The British other ranks had arrived, and they were doing quite a lot of trading because they were working outside the camp. Pilfering too. I remember they got hold of some onions once, unloading a ship. And one onion in an otherwise dull and largely saltless dish of rice made an awful lot of difference for 200 people.
You shared a wire, of course, with the British other.
Part of our wire was shared with them, yes. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, we were. On another side, we were next to the Roman fathers. Mm-hmm. And then nobody else. The next nearest were the Australian officers, I think, who were a couple of hundred yards away, beyond the rubber trees.
The wire apart, were there any restrictions, commands, to prevent you contacting the groups on either side?
Oh yes, we weren't supposed to talk through the wire.
Why do you think that was? Why should the Japanese insist upon it?
I don't know. I suppose they wanted to. It was a question of divide and rule, I suppose. They didn't want us to cooperate and get up to anything. Maybe they also realised that the troops had contact of their own kind outside, And we had, in our particular section of the camp, of course, we had contacts also of a different kind.
I'll come to that in a moment.
And I didn't want the two to get together.
Sure. We were aware that the groupings on either side of the wires and others in the overall camp were treated in any way differently from yourselves. In terms of work, rationing.
Well, the British other ranks, of course, were taken out to work and they were worked pretty hard. And they got, I think, less rations than we did. Mm-hmm. Also, they had... maybe they got the same rations, but they... a lot of them didn't know what to do with them. They didn't like rice, for a start, because they were fresh out from home. And they probably always had been underfed. They didn't like the climate. They didn't like the... they didn't know how to keep themselves clean, how much water it was necessary to use, for instance, to keep yourself not only cool but clean. And if you don't like rice, you simply don't eat. That's all there is to it. So they went downhill rather bad, and they had to do a long day's work.
Were any representations made that you know of to the Japanese to suggest that work may have been shared?
No, we didn't want to do any more work. We were, in fact, for 6 weeks at the end of 1942, we were taken up to the airfield. That was a very long day indeed. You were up at dawn and you didn't get back till dusk.
What was the nature of the work?
Knocking a hill down and extending the airfield with hoes and baskets. Just like Chinese workmen. We didn't do very much of it. There was no equipment made available. May have been one or two of these little tipper trucks, but nothing much.
And who finished the job?
Oh, the British other ranks went on with it. I suspect, too, that it's from one of the Japanese aeroplanes that they got the fine wire with which to make a coil to run their radio, which is why when some of the aeroplanes are understood to have fallen out of the air with important people on board.
Taking up this point then of contract, the radio in a moment. Beforehand you said that your own part of the camp had its own contacts. Now what would they be exactly?
Well, this interpreter, Salu, who was some kind of descendant of the African hunter, Salu. He had been in charge of Chinese affairs, so he knew all the local Chinese. And so did some others of us. I mean, and Le Gros Clark could read Chinese too. We had the Chinese consul in camp with us. So messages could be passed across the wire. Anybody who happened to be passing, you see, if you spoke the lingo, you could shout out something and he would carry the message. In addition to which, on one side of the perimeter, where we originally had a patch of land, there was a Chinese cottage. And they operated in the same way as the good lady at the second camp. They used to, I don't know what they got for it, they used to pass food under the wire. And the owner of the land on which we were in camp, I suppose the government had bought it from him, but he had been the owner, had a big estate in the area. So from time to time we used to find a duck or a couple of chickens or a pig wandering about amongst our tapioca. And thank you very much. He was dismembered and put into the tea cans on their return journey.
You referred just now to a radio. Presumably this became increasingly a morale booster as the war progressed.
Oh,
was
yes.
It very difficult to pass the news around your own camp?
It was the call of signals man, Bennett, I think his name was, who constructed it in a billy can. They had a valve from the hearing aid of one of the gentlemen from North Borneo, who went deaf for the duration and let them have his hearing aid. And they incorporated that in the radio, I understand. When the Japanese got suspicious and turned off the electricity, they got hold of a piece of bicycle and they pedalled up their current. The news was passed through by word of mouth. One of our, what he was chief secretary at the time, I think. Anyway, senior officer who was my resident after the war for a time, had the most remarkable memory, and he used to listen while somebody repeated the news to him through the wire, which meant that they could break off at any moment. And he would then go from hut to hut and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it again until everybody heard it. And his memory was such that he could read between the lines and add comments of his own. I remember on one occasion there was a piece of news that came in about the Battle of the Coral Sea or something. Or maybe it was from the newspaper, that a certain ship had been operating or had been sunk or whatever somewhere in the Pacific. And he said, now she was built in such a year, her skipper in 1941 was so-and-so. She was then on the West Atlantic run, which means that she and probably some of her sister ships, a whole flotilla, have been transferred from the Atlantic to the Pacific, so we're on, boys. But because he could remember all these details about an individual ship, he could fill out the news for us, which was indeed a morale booster.